The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the recordings of the 2016 ACOI Internal Medicine Board Review course. The course was held March 30th through April 3rd, 2016 at the Renaissance Resort at SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida. It features nationally known speakers covering topics of interest to the physician preparing for initial certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Scleroderma, lupus, and dermatomyositis is presented by Dr. Howard Feinberg.
This talk actually has more information in it than any of the others that I'm going to do. I may run a couple minutes over, and if I do, I promise I will more than make it up on the other talks and get you done on time and get us back on schedule. And we're going to talk about scleroderma, systemic lupus, dermatomyositis, polymyalgia, so other muscle diseases. It's basically all of the autoimmune diseases. Again, I have nothing to disclose. I don't have any known conflicts of interest. Haven't taken any money from the pharmaceutical industry for these diseases for a number of years. All right, we're going to start, it's cutting off, with systemic lupus erythematosus. The incidence somewhere between 15 and 50 per 100,000 in the population. It is the most common of the autoimmune diseases. The peak age is between 17 and 40. The main age of presentation is going to be younger women, age 20 to 30. In the peak ages, the ratio of female to male is 5 to 1. For all age groups, and this includes much older onset, it's about 2 to 1. So we do see men with this disease. Despite the fact that I have a white woman up there, the most common population to have this is black women. I have to keep reminding myself of that again. I come from Eastern Kentucky. We don't have a very diverse population. So I see a lot of white women and men with lupus, but the most common group to have this are gonna be black women, then white women, then black men, then white men. Lupus is not a disease by itself. The main disease most people think about when they talk about lupus is systemic lupus erythematosus. Lupus actually covers a number of diseases which make a great multiple choice question that you will see on your boards. One type is subacute cutaneous lupus. Subacute cutaneous lupus is not a systemic process, it's a skin disease where we see a non-fixed, non-scarring rash. So they may have a malar rash or butterfly rash over their face. They may have a photosensitive rash, erythematous areas on the body that will come and go, but non-fixed, non-scarring rash associated with anti-SSA antibody, originally anti-Sjogren's syndrome A antibody. The treatment for this is hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil and sun avoidance and sunscreens. The next group is discoid lupus. This also is a skin-only problem, but this has a scarring rash. So subacute cutaneous lupus, non-scarring, discoid, scarring rash. You'll see small erythematous areas that become atrophic and scar down. They're the classic lesions for this, about the size of a pencil eraser over sun-exposed areas, but you can also see large areas of atrophy and skin damage from it. Again, primary treatment for this is hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil. It's the first-line therapy for the patients. And then the next one, this has been on the boards for the last at least 7 or 8 years. Somebody has always told me, I've seen that one on the boards. You told me about it in talk. Please remember this, lupus pernio. It's not lupus. This is actually sarcoid. It's a variant of sarcoid. We get this violaceous type of rash. It can occur on the face, over the ears, can sometimes mimic a malar rash. So, it's associated with hepatic granulomas. The board question I had, they specifically had hepatic granulomas in there on the question that referred to this. 20% will have hepatomegaly. So again, it may be in the differential for your lupus questions. It was in the differential for my lupus questions for choices. It's not lupus. It's a separate disease that's sarcoid. And then we have systemic lupus, where I'm going to spend most of the time for this topic, and drug-induced lupus. Drug-induced lupus is associated with a positive ANA, and 95% of the time, a positive antihistone antibody. You can get a positive antihistone antibody in systemic lupus that is not drug-induced as well. So that test is not a definitive yes or no for drug-induced disease. The question that I saw had drug-induced lupus and had a positive antihistone antibody. So you do want to remember that it's associated with that. Typically, drug-induced disease will not have brain involvement, not have renal involvement, unusual to have cardiac and lung involvement with it. It's usually a milder form of disease. It has primarily skin, mucous membrane problems, so aphthous ulcers, malar rash, photosensitive rashes. The recommendation is if somebody's on one of these drugs, you don't get an ANA because the ANA test will turn positive in a lot of them. You get a test only if you feel that they have drug-induced lupus. And then if the tests are positive, you have to make a decision, is that drug important enough and the symptoms mild enough that we're going to continue it? Or do we need to discontinue the therapy? Some very common drugs, so Aldomet, methyldopa, INH, so TB treatment, Dilantin, quinidine, procainamide can all cause drug-induced lupus. There's a much longer list of drugs that have case reports and isolated incidences of drug-induced lupus, so you can't eliminate the possibility if they're not on one of these drugs, but these are the classic ones. Okay, this is the old lupus criteria. I hope that's not what's going to be on your boards because there are new criteria. The rest of the world adopted them about 4 years ago now, I believe 2012. The U.S. adopted them last year, so I don't know which criteria they're going to give you. That's the only reason I put these down. These are the old criteria. You had to have 4 out of 11. These are the current criteria. I don't know if we can move that down. It's cutting off the top on my slides. But this is the Systemic Lupus International Classification Criteria. It's the new criteria that you should be using. It was adopted through Europe and the rest of the world. I believe the year was 2012. I actually have it on the slide there. It was adopted officially in the United States last year. So again, the boards sometimes take 2 years to get questions in. I don't know which group is going to be there for you. These criteria also require 4 points, but for those of you who are my age before they had the China buffet restaurants, when you went to a Chinese restaurant, you pick one from column A and one from column B. With lupus, you have to have one from column A and one from column B. You have to have one clinical criteria, and you have to have at least one lab criteria now. So you can't just have 4 clinical things. The clinical criteria are up there. One is acute cutaneous lupus. This now encompasses malar rash and photosensitive rashes, so any non-scarring rash are in there. Previously, those were 2 separate criteria. And then we have chronic cutaneous lupus, and that's any scarring rash. And that includes the discoid lesions that were on the old criteria, but also lupus paniculitis, a number of other rashes that can leave scarring and damage behind. And then oral ulcers. These are painless white aphthous ulcers occurring on the mucous membranes. They can occur in the nose or mouth and meet this criteria. In my area, everybody tells me they have nasal ulcers, so I only look for oral ones to meet the criteria, but nasal ulcers will meet the definition. Non-scarring alopecia. So hair loss, my population, everybody tells me my hair is thinning. Every woman I see says, oh, I have bags full of hair on the pillows every day. So I don't count that. I look for bald spots and obvious signs of hair thinning in order to qualify for this criteria. And I'll let you guys use your judgment, but non-scarring alopecia can come back. And then arthritis, and this is 2 or more joints which have to be swollen. Pain doesn't count. Complaining of pain doesn't count. Fibromyalgia is very common in the lupus population. Somewhere between 60 and 80% of all lupus patients will have fibromyalgia and will complain to you that they hurt all over. That doesn't count. They have to have swelling synovitis in 2 or more joints. And then serositis, either pleurisy or pericarditis. Renal involvement, which is now defined as more than 500 milligrams of protein in a 24-hour urine, or red blood cell casts, or a positive biopsy. Previously, this was a biopsy diagnosis. You're no longer required to do the biopsy. And I'll tell you, in my practice, we biopsy everyone, but it isn't required for the criteria for lupus. And then neurologic, and this used to be really nebulous. Everyone agreed. You have a lupus patient, they start seizing. That's CNS or neuropsychiatric lupus. No one could agree, well, if they have personality changes, if they're acting funny, does that qualify? So now we've defined it. Seizures, Frank's psychosis, myelitis, mononeuritis multiplex, acute confusional state, or cranial neuropathies all count as neuropsychiatric lupus. We've changed the name from cerebritis, because on MRI they don't have inflammation, so no cerebritis. It's now neuropsychiatric lupus. And then hemolytic anemia, you have to prove hemolysis, leukopenia or thrombocytopenia. I don't know why, but these are part of the clinical criteria. They're all lab tests, but those come under the column A clinical criteria. And then all the weird lab stuff that rheumatologists do, that's the lab criteria. So positive ANA, anti-double-stranded DNA, anti-Smith antibody, SM isn't smooth muscle in this case, anti-Smith, anti-phospholipid antibody, low complement levels, and a direct Coombs test in the absence of hemolysis. You can't use it for both criteria. Again, you have to have four. So one clinical, one immunologic criteria. In addition to that, you can get to the diagnosis in patients who just have renal disease. So someone who presents with acute glomerulonephritis, who has a positive ANA or a positive anti-double-stranded DNA and on biopsy looks like lupus nephritis, they now qualify as systemic lupus with no other criteria. Rheumatologists, that's been an area where we've always struggled. I've had, over the years, occasional patients with this, one every year or two that would show up. We'd say, okay, well, they have what looks like lupus nephritis, what on biopsy is called the full house. They have IgG, IgA, IgM, complement levels all coming back abnormal on their biopsy. They have a positive ANA, they didn't meet other criteria, what do we do with them? And the answer is, they're by definition now systemic lupus, and you treat them the same way. Okay, so this is a true systemic disease. I mentioned neuropsychiatric disease, seizures, psychosis, those criteria. This disease can also affect the heart. Please remember Lehman-Sachs endocarditis. You need to remember this for two reasons. One is you can save your patients from having valve surgery, and the other is it will show up on your boards. It's been there the last 3 years in a row. Okay, Lehman-Sachs endocarditis look like warts on valve leaflets. They can also occur on the chordae. They're a benign finding associated with systemic lupus. Occasionally, very rarely, they can compromise the chordae and can cause rupture. But most of the time, they're just present. They're not an infectious process. It's part of the differential for infective endocarditis, and especially in a systemic lupus patient. I have had three patients in the last year alone that I canceled their valve surgeries. They were admitted with endocarditis. It was felt to be refractory to treatment. They had changes on their echocardiograms that did not go away. They were scheduled for surgery. They had systemic lupus. They had Lehman-Sachs endocarditis. Their cultures were negative. We canceled their surgeries. Okay, this has been a board question regularly. It's also something really important for all of you to remember clinically. You can also see almost any arrhythmia. The most common arrhythmia in all of the autoimmune diseases, the most common arrhythmia is atrial fibrillation. That's because it's the most common arrhythmia for everybody. The most common abnormal arrhythmia that has a much higher incidence in the autoimmune diseases, supraventricular tachycardia. It was there last year. Hasn't been there the last couple of years before that. So supraventricular tachycardia is highly associated, actually, with the autoimmune diseases. You can see it with all of them, not just systemic lupus. So it's something to keep in mind. For renal, these are the different pathologic classifications. We now know if you biopsy different areas of the kidney, you'll see different versions of this. So we don't put as much stock in it as we used to. And this is what a nephron will look like, the green inflammation, that's immune globulin in the nephron in a lupus patient. Okay, treatment. Symptomatic. The patients come to you and they're complaining that they feel like crap. If you don't help them feel better, they probably won't come back. So you do want to address their symptoms. The number one treatment for a systemic lupus, hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil. It's the same thing for all the skin versions of lupus, hydroxychloroquine. That used to be a treatment that we used early in the disease, and then if they got worse, we'd switch them to something else. That's gone away. It's gone away for a very important reason. This is the only drug that has now been proven to prevent future worsening and future flares of disease. So every patient with systemic lupus should be put on this and kept on it from then on. The rest of the treatments are used based on how severe the disease is. So if hydroxychloroquine and using sunscreen to prevent photosensitive rashes and using Orajel or baby teething medicines when their oral ulcers get painful and using non-steroidals or injections when their joints bother them isn't enough, the next level up would be either methotrexate or azathioprine. You can also use low doses of CellCept, mycophenolate, mofetil in that classification. You can also use short courses of steroids. I really don't recommend long-term steroid use for any of my patients or any patients with this disease. If those things aren't enough, we also have an IV monoclonal antibody. That's Benlysta. Benlysta was first developed to try and replace cyclophosphamide. It's not strong enough to do that. It's used in conjunction with other treatments to help ameliorate diseases. It works better in the white population than the black population. We don't really know why, but it's failed its testing for the black population with lupus. And then for renal involvement, the drug of choice is becoming mycophenolate mofetil. Don't know why, but in my practice, we have patients developing renal disease who are on that drug. We've had almost every one of my patients fail that therapy. That's not what I hear from my other colleagues around the country who tell me it's working great for their patients. So that is becoming the drug of choice for renal involvement. And the other option is Cytoxan or cyclophosphamide. Cyclophosphamide is still the drug of choice for neuropsychiatric disease. Okay, scleroderma. Scleroderma, like lupus, is not a single disease. It's a reference to the appearance of the skin where it gets thick and hard. So I'm going to tell you everything that you need to know for your boards about scleroderma diseases. It makes things thick and hard. The main disease is progressive systemic sclerosis. If you remember physiology and you think about what would happen to that organ or that part of the body if it got thick and hard, you then know everything that you need to know about this disease. So you don't have to memorize everything about it. It's a fairly uncommon disease. The incidence is roughly 0.5 per 100,000 in the population. Peak age is about 40 years old, more common in women. If you get asked on boards, is it more common in men than in women? Almost all the rheumatologic diseases are more common in women. The exception for that would be gout and ankylosing spondylitis. Otherwise, pick women. Okay, so the scleroderma diseases come in a couple of flavors. One is localized disease, the next CREST, then toxic scleroderma, and then progressive systemic sclerosis. And this is the current classification system. They've tried to eliminate CREST syndrome and plunk that in with both systemic and localized, and no one really went for it, so it's kept as a separate category for right now. Localized scleroderma patients will have a positive ANA and a positive anti-centromere antibody. And then this is the old linear or morphia. Linear is just a band of thick, hard skin somewhere on the body. Morphia is a patch of thick, hard skin somewhere in the body. They're mainly a problem if they cross a joint space and cause a contracture, or if they're on their face and cause deformities. But it's not a systemic process. It's a localized skin process. The next is CREST syndrome. CREST stands for calcinosis, Raynaud's, esophageal motility problems, sclerodactyly, telangiectasia. You have to have at least three of those to qualify under that category. Then toxic scleroderma is what it sounds like, scleroderma being caused by an outside toxin, and progressive systemic sclerosis associated with a positive ANA and SCL70, which stands for scleroderma 70. You should know, I'm a rheumatologist, we're not inventive people. If it sounds like it, it's probably correct. SSA, Sjogren's syndrome A, SCL, scleroderma. Sorry, we're kind of the stepchild in medicine, and you know, we just couldn't come up with new, inventive, wonderful terms. So if you're taking boards and it sounds like it, it's probably not a trick question on the boards. Okay. So this is localized scleroderma. Sorry, that top is cut off, so I don't know which topics we have in which order here. Localized scleroderma is primarily in the extremities, in the hands. It's distal to the MCP joints. There's no internal organ involvement. It's generally not treated. We don't have good treatment for any of the scleroderma-like diseases, and this one is not systemic. It includes, again, linear scleroderma and morphia. CREST syndrome, I mentioned the components of it. This is a person with Raynaud's phenomenon. To diagnose Raynaud's phenomenon, you have to have a minimum of two color changes. Raynaud's is a vasospastic problem. Somebody experiences cold temperatures or high emotions, and the blood vessel clamps down in spasms, cuts off circulation, and the fingers turn white, which would be the hand to your left, where the ends of the fingers are all white. If it goes on too long, they get cyanotic, they turn blue. And then the blood vessel will eventually relax as the hands warm up or the person calms down, and it'll flush as the blood rushes in and they get red. So we call them the patriotic hands. They get red, white, and blue. You got to have at least two colors, and it's got to be that order: white first, then red, then blue. This is a person with extremely bad Raynaud's phenomenon. The other hand is missing a finger. I like to trick my medical students with that one. Okay, toxic scleroderma. Toxic scleroderma is a systemic-looking disease, can be just as bad as progressive systemic sclerosis. It's associated with specific toxins. One is rapeseed oil. Rapeseed oil, otherwise called the gourmet cooking oil of Spain syndrome. Rapeseed oil is a cheap substitute for olive oil in Europe. So if you can't afford good oil, you get rapeseed oil. For some reason, it got imported into the United States at all the gourmet cooking shops as this wonderful gourmet oil at twice the price of all of the others, and it was a fad for a while. It started causing scleroderma-like changes. It was actually banned from importation into the United States. About 4 years ago, they lifted the ban. So it's back. You'll see rapeseed oil, and I've actually seen it on websites advertised with all these miraculous cures that it's supposed to have now. So they're trying to promote it again in the United States. So most likely we'll start seeing toxic scleroderma from it again. You also have the eosinophilia myalgia syndrome. It's associated with a specific strain of bacteria emitted by an E. coli that got into a plant in Japan where most of the L-tryptophan in the world was created. It also was banned for importation in the United States. That ban was lifted when they found out that it was because of an infection in the factory. So it's now included in a lot of items that you can buy in the United States. Patients will get rashes, can have fevers, can have arthralgias, and get scleroderma-like skin changes, and the treatment is get off the L-tryptophan. We haven't had a major outbreak in the United States recently, but all it takes is one E. coli bacterial contamination where it's being made to, again, see that. And then my favorite, and I put this on every year, I have to do this because my wife's maiden name was Shulman. And it was known as Shulman syndrome. Now it's diffuse fasciitis with eosinophilia. I put it in there more as a joke, saying, this is one of these just rheumatologists deal with it. He was on the boards last year. So now I'm glad that I've been putting this in every year, and I want you to all get this question right. These are patients who have no systemic features. They're usually young, and they get an episode of skin inflammation followed by skin thickening, usually after strenuous exercise. I never really thought I'd see a case of this either. I went years searching for one. I figured I had to find one eventually just because of my wife. It was kind of like maple syrup urine disease. It just wasn't out there for me. And then I had a high school football player walk into my office with a patch of scleroderma on his back, and he said, "Well, every time we do a double exercise, this rash gets inflamed, and then it leaves the stuff behind." Had Shulman syndrome. The treatment for it is avoid real strenuous aerobic exercise. That'll stop it from progressing. All right, progressive systemic sclerosis. Again, this is a disease that makes things thick and hard. So we have pulmonary fibrosis, cardiac fibrosis. It is associated with Raynaud's, okay? Most systemic lupus patients are gonna have a positive ANA. Virtually all progressive systemic sclerosis patients are gonna have Raynaud's phenomenon. If you cannot get a history of Raynaud's, don't see Raynaud's in that population, you probably have the wrong disease. It's a good thing to remember for the boards. Every case of this that I've seen on the boards has had Raynaud's phenomenon. It's highly associated with this disease. They also get Sicca complex, dry eyes and dry mouth. Why? The glands get thick and hard and they don't work, so you don't get fluids. We see accelerated hypertension, one of the ways that patients with this will die. That's because they get unilateral hardening of a renal artery. The kidney registers this as insufficient blood flow and pumps up the blood pressure, and when it doesn't work, pumps it up higher and higher. The treatment for that is to put the patients on an ACE inhibitor. We used to recommend that every patient with systemic sclerosis get an ACE inhibitor at diagnosis. We learned that that actually increases the mortality rate. So now the recommendation is that you only treat them after hypertension is established. But this can be life-saving. So remember, ACE inhibitor for accelerated hypertension, for hypertension in a scleroderma patient, for a scleroderma patient with a renal crisis. All right, for diagnosis, there's a point system like what we're developing for all the autoimmune diseases. This one is about 3 years old now. So fair game for the boards. Number one is skin thickening. So the skin gets thick and hard. If it's proximal to the MCP joints, you get 9 points. That's an automatic diagnosis. You have enough points. Puffy fingers, the first stage of this is just non-pitting edema in the hands or in the feet or both. You get 2 points for that. Skin thickening distal to the MCP joints, that could be limited disease. So you get 4 points for that one. Digital pitting ulcers or ulcers on the tips of the fingers get you 2 points. Pitting scars get you 3 points. Telangiectasias associated with Kress syndrome, but also systemic sclerosis gets 2 points. Abnormal nail fold capillaries, and any of you don't have a nail fold capillary microscope in your office, it's very simple. You can put a drop of oil on the finger, dial your ophthalmoscope up to 40, and move your head up and down and focus on the nail fold capillaries. Normal is not to see any. Sometimes you'll see linear ones that can be a normal variant. These look like little tufted mushrooms. So abnormal nail fold capillaries. I always get strange looks from my patients when I'm doing this. It's like, don't you know that's for the eye? But a good quick trick that you can use in your offices. And then pulmonary involvement, either pulmonary hypertension. It occurs between 25 and 50% of these patients. You get 2 points. Interstitial lung disease, another cause of death in this population, 2 points. Raynaud's, 3 points. Again, virtually all of these patients will have Raynaud's. And then 3 points for antibodies. For treatment, we got a lot of treatments. None of them really work. So the old typical treatment is penicillamine. It was shown to work by the Pittsburgh group, the major researchers in scleroderma, and then they showed that it didn't work. So it's kind of gone in and out of popularity. It's still being used in different areas in the country. It seems to be very regional for response rate. If you pull out the textbook now, there's a little paragraph that says, this seems to work for the disease, but no one's using it anymore. So I can't really tell you where it fits. My expectation is that, you know, it's kind of on the downswing now and it'll probably pop up again later. It's higher use, but penicillamine, one of the treatments. Steroids, recent studies have shown that steroids have no real advantage in these patients. They just don't work. So not really recommended for long-term therapy. Methotrexate has been used for a long time. The data over the past year, again, 2 years is usually the lead time for board questions. Data over the last year showing methotrexate doesn't work. We have some data showing that it'll improve symptoms. We don't have any data showing that it alters the course of the disease. Cyclophosphamide does work for pulmonary disease, so it is the recommended treatment for interstitial lung disease at this stage. We do have treatments for pulmonary artery hypertension. So you want to get a screening echocardiogram to look for pulmonary artery hypertension in all of these patients every year. And if you see it, a right heart catheterization, and then treatment for that process. And then we've got other immunosuppressive therapy. The most common one in use now is mycophenolate mofetil, and that's currently the newest drug that everyone thinks is going to work for this disease. Data is not very impressive. So again, we don't have great treatments for this disorder. The life expectancy has increased a little bit. 3 years ago, it was under 5 years. Now it's about 7 years. But most of these patients will still die from their disease. The major reasons why they die are sequela from pulmonary artery hypertension, accelerated hypertension, and pulmonary involvement from their disease. Okay, so in my last couple minutes, we're gonna cover all the idiopathic inflammatory myopathies. That's polymyositis, dermatomyositis, inclusion body myositis, malignancy associated, and I know this is internal medicine, but I'm gonna throw in about 2 seconds on juvenile too. So these are all different variants of a disease. They can also be associated with other autoimmune processes. The incidence, again, more common in women, like most autoimmune diseases. It's about 0.6 per million in the population, so fairly rare diseases. Peak age in the kids is 12, 13, for adults 50 years old. And we're gonna start with polymyositis. Polymyositis causes proximal muscle weakness with no pain. So remember that, proximal muscle weakness, no pain. These patients don't hurt. They may say their muscles get sore when they try and do too much because they're so weak, but the disease itself is not a painful disease. They have no rash and they have an elevated CPK. So you diagnose these patients first by suspecting it. They tell you, I'm having trouble going up and down stairs. I can't get up out of a chair. I'm having trouble moving. You test them. You find proximal muscle weakness and no distal muscle weakness. You get a CPK, and it's typically very high. These patients do not have a CPK of 500. Those are usually the metabolic myopathies. They have a CPK of 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, so very high. You then get an EMG nerve conduction study, which will show a typical myopathic pattern, nothing diagnostic about it. And then you get a muscle biopsy, which will also show a typical inflammatory pattern, nothing specific diagnostic about it. You put the whole pattern together: proximal muscle weakness, elevated CPK, abnormal EMG, and an abnormal muscle biopsy, you make the diagnosis. If they have a rash, then they have dermatomyositis. The classic is a heliotrope rash. If you see that on board, skip to the bottom, circle heliotrope, and move on. So heliotrope rash is my first picture there, redness across the eyes. Groton's papules also, that was on the boards last year. Groton's papules, if you see that, skip to the bottom, circle dermatomyositis, move on. Those are white bumps over the knuckles. They can also get other interesting rashes, mechanics hands, where they get increased pigment in the creases, positive V sign, which is an area where the V-neck shirt would turn red, where the opening is, shawl sign, an area where a woman's shawls over the shoulders would turn red. And I know my time is up, and I promise I will make it up on other talks. I just have a couple more seconds here. So these are patients who have polymyositis and have a rash. They then have dermatomyositis. The next group is inclusion body myositis. These are ones that look like polymyositis or dermatomyositis, but when you do electron microscopic evaluation or their muscle biopsy, you see inclusions. They tend to be resistant to therapy. So you want to get light microscopy, you want to get enzymatic testing, and you want to get electron microscopy on your muscle biopsies. These can be familial, they can also be sporadic, again, refractory to treatment. And then the next group is going to be malignancy associated, either poly or dermatomyositis. Again, looks the same, but is associated with cancer. It's associated with the cancer that would be the most likely for that age group. So if you have an elderly smoker, lung cancer. If you have somebody who's 65 or 70 years old, male, you want to look for colon cancer, prostate cancer. For women, the only type of cancer that has a higher incidence than the general population from that age, ovarian cancer. So every woman with this should be screened for ovarian cancer. We recommend that all patients with polymyositis or dermatomyositis have cancer screening. And if it's negative and their disease changes or relapses, you screen them again. So I had a patient not too long ago, it's about a year and a half ago now, who I will never forget, came into the office, had typical features of polymyositis. We did a chest x-ray and a CT of the chest that was negative. We did a CT of the abdomen and pelvis that was negative. He had a colonoscopy that was negative. He had a prostate exam, was also negative. PSA was normal. Was started on therapy, started to improve, relapsed. Had another CT done of his abdomen and was found to have metastatic renal cell carcinoma, and unfortunately died. So patients with this may have cancers in a very early stage. This can be a paraneoplastic process. It can clue you off that cancer is somewhere in the body and potentially curable. You need to screen them. If they have polymyositis and you're treating them and they develop a rash and become dermatomyositis, you rescreen them. If they have this disease and they relapse, and the normal course for this disease is that it will get better and then will relapse, if they relapse, you screen them again. And all women get screened for ovarian cancer. Okay, I put up the childhood form just so I could talk about all the systemic features because the kids have more of them. This is a picture of subcutaneous calcium deposits. I've seen this treated as abscesses. They get thick white stuff draining out of their pockets of their skin. You can also see this in scleroderma patients. If you press a slide to it, look at it under the microscope, you're gonna see calcium crystals. You're not gonna see white cells. So it's a very easy way to separate these out. Remember, they can have thick white stuff draining out of areas that's not an infection. They also can get interstitial lung disease, cardiomyopathy, supraventricular tachycardia, so a lot of the systemic features that we see with all of the other autoimmune diseases. And then amyopathic, this was on the boards again, so I want to cover it again very quickly. They have typical skin lesions of dermatomyositis, but they have normal muscles. No muscle weakness, a normal CPK. They may complain of some fatigue. It's caused to abnormal ATP in the muscles. It's amyopathic dermatomyositis. They have the skin rash, but they don't have the muscle weakness. The other disease that can do that is subacute cutaneous lupus. If you biopsy them, the biopsy of those rashes is identical. Okay, we talked about that. And I'm going to skip ahead to my last disease and then finish up, so I'm not too far over my schedule. And this is polymyalgia rheumatica. Again, this disease criteria changed a couple of years ago, so this is fair game. You have to have 4 points. Polymyalgia rheumatica is the opposite pattern of polymyositis. Polymyositis is muscle weakness with no pain. Polymyalgia rheumatica is muscle pain with no weakness. It's the proximal muscles. The criteria are morning stiffness. You get 2 points for that. Hip pain, they all have to have shoulder girdle pain. So hip pain, you get another point for that. Negative laboratory testing will get you 2 points. An absence of other joint problems will get you another point. And then if you do musculoskeletal ultrasound, if you look at the subdeltoid bursa, biceps, glenohumeral areas, any of those areas positive, you get another point for each of those. You have to have 4 points without ultrasound, 6 points with ultrasound to make the diagnosis. It is required that they have an elevated SED rate and they're over the age of 50. This is a disease of the elderly. So the classic patient with polymyalgia rheumatica will be a 70 or 80 year old who comes in complaining of severe pain, and when you test them, their distal muscles are fine. You squeeze their forearms, no pain. You squeeze their shoulder girdle muscles, they're having a lot of pain. Their SED rate is 108. They have no symptoms of other problems causing it. The treatment for that is prednisone. You put them on it, the pain goes away very quickly. The old criteria used to be they had to respond to less than 10 milligrams of prednisone. We now know only about 50% of patients will respond to less than 20 milligrams of prednisone. So we don't use response to prednisone as the criteria. Again, this is the criteria, typically 80-year-old person, high SED rate, proximal muscle pain, and a rapid improvement.